Hey there, podcast listeners. It's Maria, and thanks for listening to Latino USA. If you like our interviews, well, check out NPR's Fresh Air with Terry Gross. You'll hear revealing conversations with your favorite actors, directors, comedians, musicians, and authors. And you'll discover new voices, too. You can find Fresh Air at npr.org/podcasts. From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa.
I come here to see my husband. I've been here since 2009, traveling back and forth on a monthly basis. It's a lot. It's a whole Sunday.
When someone goes to prison, it's not just that person who has time taken from them. Today, we hear how family members struggle to visit their loved ones on the inside. And a man fighting cancer forms a bond with the driver who takes him to treatment.
I'm very happy. I'm not going to see your face again. I mean in the good way.
I'm very glad for you, you know. You're going to be okay.
Plus, the fight over the construction of a new canal in Nicaragua. All this and more coming up on Latino USA as we talk about getting there. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. In New York State, there are 54 correctional facilities, including prison-style drug rehab centers. They're scattered across the state, and most of them are in tiny towns far from major cities. There are lots of factors that determine which one you actually get sent to, which prisons have space, which prisons are better at housing certain kinds of offenders. All of these things are out of your control when you're behind bars. On today's show, we're talking about getting there, how we get from one place to another. And to start our show, we're going to talk about prison, but not about the people on the inside. Instead, we're focusing on the families on the outside, families that make the trip to visit their locked-up loved ones, often far away from home. Latino USA producer Michael Simon Johnson has our story.
The bus from the city to the Hudson Valley prisons leaves promptly at 5:15 in the morning. I'm at Atlantic Terminal near downtown Brooklyn. I expected that there would be a bus waiting, but instead there were four loading people on and getting ready to disperse across the state. Who knows how many buses were there earlier in the morning or how many will be there later. It isn't the most organized and it isn't exactly cheap. But there is an infrastructure set up to do this. It's just one element of the prison industrial complex geared towards prisoners' families. The mood on the bus is far from positive. It's early, so most people are trying to sleep, but even those awake seem lost in thought, tense. And it doesn't help that the radio is playing gospel. A hardly subtle suggestion that there is a right path and a wrong path. And this trip has everything to do with the wrong path.
And Bert, good morning.
This bus, part of a prison transportation company called Manny's, is going to a few prisons that are relatively close to the city. We're not going far. On paper, it should take about 2 hours. But we stop to pick people up twice in Queens, once more in the Bronx, and then drop people off at three separate prisons, Greenhaven, then Hudson, then Coxsackie, and then a juvenile detention center called Brookwood. Just a one-way trip ends up taking close to 4 hours.
30, 29, 28, 22, and 20.
And you have five kids? Big family.
I got a big family.
Evelyn Melendez from Queens is one of the passengers taking this four-hour trip to visit her husband at the Coxsackie prison. It's a 1,000-person maximum security prison in a town of only 9,000 people.
I come here to see my husband. I've been here since 2009, traveling back and forth on a monthly basis.
Evelyn's husband was sentenced in 2009, and he has 2 years left on his sentence. Understandably, she was hesitant to tell me why. But she's had other family members in prison, and she's become familiar with the process of actually getting to the facilities.
I was lucky enough he was here. It's a three-hour ride. So, but it's a lot. It's a whole Sunday. Because I left my house at 4:30 in the morning, and I won't get home until 6:37 tonight.
Visiting someone in prison is an event.
Absolutely. I mean, the distance.
Maurice Winley is a youth development specialist who runs the Harlem branch of ARCHES, an intervention program for youth in New York City.
You can look at a DOC state correction map. You know, you're talking about some jails being 1,000 miles, you know, up near Canada.
First call, Green.
When we get to the first stop, Greenhaven Prison in Dutchess County, the bus driver, a guy named Victor Bullen, gets word that a snowstorm is approaching and that the bus will have to depart early, cutting into the visitation time.
Pickup time is 2 o'clock today.
What? Why?
Needless to say, most people are not happy about it.
They've been saying that before.
Yeah, you know,
they've been saying that before. They should be giving people back their money somewhere.
People come on the bus with attitudes, you know what I mean? They must remember that and they're.
Victor is in his 70s and has been driving buses for nearly 3 decades, including these prison visitation buses. He says he's seen a lot and has learned to handle the collective stress that people bring on the bus.
Most people have to get out of the bed, all the comfort of their homes, and stick on this ride for 2.5 hours, 3 hours. So it could be frustrating at times.
Here's Maurice Winley again.
These are typically low income. These are typically individuals who are dependent on public transportation. And so it becomes that much more arduous in terms of really being able to lay out a sensible travel plan.
You don't have to let a prison know in advance you're coming. But Evelyn Melendez, who's going to visit her husband, says sometimes that actually can cause problems.
Yes. It's a chance you're taking, though, when you show up just like that, because if the inmate can be moved today, let's say today at 7 o'clock in the morning, they can take an inmate and tell him, pack, you're leaving to another correction facility. And they don't give him that opportunity, that chance to call a loved one from home and let them know, I am being transferred.
If he knows you guys are coming that day, he can't
right,
call
he
you.
Can't call at all. And they don't warn them when they're leaving.
Does that what happened to your husband?
Hasn't happened to him, but it happens.
Basically, every time you go to a prison to visit a family member, you're taking a bit of a gamble.
You can go say, well, I'm going to go see, you know, so-and-so. And when you get there, they'll tell you he's not there.
At Coxsackie Prison, while the passengers head inside to visit loved ones, I use the opportunity to ask Victor, the bus driver, about his passengers. For example, they were almost all Black and Latino women.
Well, why do you think it's mostly women on the bus?
Well, women, regardless of what they say, man, women are more kind-hearted creatures. You know what I'm saying? Because you really have to make an effort to do this trip. Guys seldom do things like that. I think it's all because of the kind-heartedness of women in general.
As 2 o'clock rolls around, the time when Victor told passengers he would have to leave, I ask him what would happen if someone doesn't show up for the return trip.
So if you have to take off.
Yes, I do. And if they're not here, well, then not too far from here, we just came from, there is the Amtrak train. So they have to get a ride up to Hudson.
How do they even do that?
Well, they'll have to call a cab.
All right, Victor, we're leaving.
Yeah, well, just about. Let's see if we get everyone, you know.
Well, you said 2 o'clock.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. My husband was like, nobody else is walking out. They don't have to walk out. They didn't walk in with me.
I know.
I got my babies to go home to.
Mm-hmm. The ride back to New York, just as long as the ride up, is far more lighthearted. The mood on the bus is chattier, more upbeat.
One of the girls, she was saying that she lives, I want to say, an hour away from this correction facility, but it costs her like $115
to
get here. Meanwhile, if she goes all the way to the Bronx and takes this bus. To get here, it's like $60, $70 she's wasting.
So even though she's closer to the facility,
it costs her more money. It's almost double. Not double, but almost double. For her to get here, then going all the way to the Bronx.
There are no state-run bus services to take family members to prisons. Only these private companies like Manny's. This trip to the Hudson Valley costs $40 per person, but to go even farther, like to Clinton near Canada or to prisons near Buffalo or Rochester, the cost is much greater.
Easily $100 or more, you know, round trip per person. You know, that's a conservative figure. It's expensive. And believe me, the visits are not frequent.
And Maurice says the cost goes beyond money. Maurice himself served 18 months in prison when he was younger. He remembers what it was like to have his family come visit him.
Myself, being a person who was on the inside and having family come to visit me and just seeing their faces, you could just see how they was just, you know, purely exhausted. You know, that was the look, you know, like they just were drained, but at the same time happy to see you. But as a person, you can just see that they've gone through something coming to see you. And I think that is just one of those hidden social collateral consequences that we really haven't been able to gauge. I've spoken to families, particularly with juveniles, where it's even more accentuated because, again, this is a child. No matter what label a criminal justice system, a judge, a prosecutor places on a child, criminal, juvenile, delinquent, that parent, that's my child.
This long, painful process has another dimension as well. Being in prison can itself be a traumatic experience, but that trauma can be exacerbated by the long-distance separation from family.
It's profound, being separated from the ones who care about you while you're in this place of punishment. And what that does in terms of the scarring, the stigma, and I believe this is why recidivism is where it is.
This belief is correct. A study from the Minnesota Department of Corrections showed that family visitations have sharp effects on lowering recidivism, which is the rate at which people return to prison after they've been released. And there are numerous other studies confirming this. Interestingly, visits from ex-spouses actually increase recidivism. And a lack of visitation from other immediate family members like parents or siblings means higher recidivism as well.
Obviously, you're in this place of pain, and so you're going to look for justification. Most of the times, you know, most people are not mature enough, particularly adolescent and youth, to see themselves as part of the problem. So you're going to look at, you know, some of those dysfunctional relationships, some of those missed opportunities, and those become coal, if you will, for anger and for frustration and bitterness.
Without proper or affordable transportation access, family members in New York have to do the best they can to visit as frequently as possible. Those visits are crucial to keeping their loved ones feeling connected to the outside world, a necessary part of reintegrating them into society upon release. But the journey to make those visits possible isn't easy. At night, the bus pulls back into Atlantic Terminal in Brooklyn. Moods have improved since when we boarded the bus early in the morning. But this late, the sky is just as dark. For Latino USA, I'm Michael Simon Johnson.
Coming up on Latino USA.
Somos gente hospitalaria, gente humana, muy amable.
Nicaraguans are very polite, open people. But as well as they can hand you the olive branch, they can hand you, cut you up with a machete.
The construction of a new canal in Nicaragua causes strife on the ground. Stay with us. No se vayan.
Algo se hunde y no estoy aquí. Todo tan deprisa, desadicto.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Inada, maker of the DreamWave massage chair, Japanese crafted with shiatsu point detection, and 16 pre-programmed massages, including morning, night, and full body sessions. Learn more at dreamwavechair.com. And Lumber Liquidators, with a floor finder app to help find sustainably harvested flooring, including exotic and domestic hardwood, bamboo, and cork. More information is available at lumberliquidators.com or 1-800-HARDWOOD.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Earlier on our program, we talked about the physical journey to prison. But now we're going to zoom in a bit more on how students can wind up in the criminal justice system. About 40% of the nation's local law enforcement agencies have full-time officers policing public schools. That's according to a Congressional Research Service report from 2013. Now, having cops in schools has also coincided with a decline in crime. But some critics say cops in schools can make troublesome behavior worse and can steer kids into the system. Gwen Hogan has our story.
Cars. 4-year-old Armani Garcia and his mom Eunice are riding on a train heading west out of New York City.
Look, come see the rivers.
Wetlands and parking lots and factories flit by. The two are on their way to the Hudson County Correctional Facility in New Jersey. Armani's dad is in detention there. How Armani's dad Ibrahim ended up behind bars is a long story. Back in 1998, when Ibrahim was just about Armani's age, a sea change was happening. That's when the New York police first took control of security in city schools. Today, there are over 5,000 school safety agents in New York City schools, more than the number of guidance counselors. They guard entrances and man metal detectors. Most of them don't carry guns, but they are police officers. They do have the power to give summonses and to make arrests. Usually, it's for disorderly conduct or for assault.
All too often, it takes the form of a simple fistfight in the schoolyard or in a hallway over whatever petty things adolescents typically fight about.
Alexis Carderon is a lawyer with the New York Civil Liberties Union. She represents students who've run into disciplinary trouble at school. Kids can get arrested for fighting, for stealing, for trespassing, even for being too loud in the hallway.
In some schools, kids get to be kids. Kids get to make mistakes. Whereas in other schools, kids don't get to be kids. They get shuttled into the criminal justice system for really minor, typical misbehavior.
Sometimes, advocates say, regular contact with the police can snowball into something more sinister. Amelia Frank works with Community Connections for Youth, a nonprofit that provides support for students who've been in legal trouble.
We've seen young people that get arrested and go to the precinct for 6 hours and come out and tell stories of being locked up. Nah, baby, that's not lockup. That's the precinct. Or you know, going to bookings and being like, you know, I was in jail. Like, no, that's the bookings. That's not jail. But there's a certain level of desensitization when a young person experiences that. Then when they do go, there's like another like, oh, this was destined to happen.
Most of the time, school safety agents, like their title implies, are there to protect students.
Schools sometimes need help with security, because the kids will tell you.
Pedro Noguera is an education professor at New York University.
Especially when schools are drawing kids from many different neighborhoods, you often have different gang affiliations in the neighborhood or turf rivalries. And so the bringing the police to school was seen as a step to try to assure some degree of safety.
Often it works. The most recent numbers from the city's Department of Education show that major crimes in schools have fallen to their lowest level since school policing started in the late 90s. But there can also be unintended consequences. At some troubled schools where teachers and administrators are already stretched thin, it's easier to rely on school safety than to deal with troublesome behavior in more creative ways. The result, says Professor Noguera, is that the kids who need the most guidance get pushed further away from the classroom and closer to prison.
We think there's just a few bad kids. If we could suspend them, then everybody else will be able to learn. And what we ignore is the way in which the conditions may, in fact, be producing the bad behavior. Invariably, those that we haven't educated are the ones we're most likely to incarcerate.
The New York Police Department did not respond to multiple telephone and email requests for comment made over a period of several months. The union that represents school safety agents declined to comment. Ibrahim Garcia is dressed in an orange jumpsuit. He pushes past a thick door that opens into a beige cinder block visiting room. 4-year-old Armani and his mom Eunice visit him here at the Hudson County Correctional Facility as much as they can. Their last visit was a few days ago.
He talks a lot more now. Then he kept pulling my beard. He's fascinated with my beard.
Ibrahim was just entering kindergarten in the Bronx when police took over security in public schools. Now he's 21.
Because when I used to go to middle school, I used to go every day to school, do my work.
But in high school, Ibrahim started having issues.
I kept getting into fights over dumb stuff, little kid stuff.
There were the kids from the projects across from his high school who would try to take his lunch money. There were the kids that hassled him on the bus he took to get to school. And he admits he had a temper. The first high school he went to encouraged him to get a safety transfer, so he did, but he kept having troubles. Then one day...
I came to school, trying to be a cool kid, show off for people. I seen this kid, he was showing off too, so I took his jacket.
Ibrahim got arrested and then suspended. 5 years probation for taking a jacket. He was 16. Ibrahim spent 60 days at a facility for kids with long-term suspensions. For him, that was the beginning of the end. He'd fallen behind and no longer felt welcome at any school.
Then I had a teacher tell me that I was going to go to jail one time. And he said, yeah, you're going to go to Attica one day. You're going to be serving jail time. I thought about it. I said, well, I proved him right. I should have proved him wrong, but I proved him right.
This is how. One night, Ibrahim was on his way to a party with some friends and was stopped and frisked. He had a gun on him.
I wasn't going to use it on nobody. I wasn't going to harm nobody. I just thought I was cool.
Ibrahim was 17 and tried as an adult. He spent 9 months in prison at Rikers Island waiting for his trial, then the rest of a 2-year sentence upstate. A few days before he was scheduled for release, he was transferred to an immigration detention center. Ibrahim is Dominican. He's undocumented. His time behind bars hasn't been easy.
And that's not a place to be, prison. Mm-mm. Away from your family. Sheesh.
It's forced him to grow up fast.
I calmed down a lot. I used to have an anger problem. I have a lot of patience now. A lot of patience.
Now he's got an infectious smile and he radiates tranquility. Most of all, he's determined to set a better example for Armani.
And I want my kids to have education, and I don't want him to be like, my dad doesn't have a school, my dad doesn't go to school. I'm going to let him, show him the right way. I love that little kid a lot. That's why I changed for him.
After the visit is up, Ibrahim's wife Eunice and Armani gather their coats and layer up.
He said that the visit went by really fast. I feel like we were in there like 10 minutes.
In the taxi on their way home, Eunice breaks open a pack of cookies she stashed in her purse.
Give me some cookie, Mom. It is mine.
Eunice will keep shuttling back and forth to the detention center while Ibrahim's green card issues get sorted out. Chances of him getting to stay in the country are actually good since he's married to a U.S. citizen. If all goes according to plan, he should be out by the fall, just in time to see Armani start kindergarten. For Latino USA, I'm Gwen Hogan in New York.
Tell me a secret.
I love myself.
And now, we're moving on to Central America, where work has begun on the Nicaragua Canal, a new waterway planned between the Atlantic and the Pacific. The $50 billion project will be funded by a Chinese development company, and it promises up to 250,000 new jobs for people in Nicaragua. But environmentalists and some campesinos along the canal route are determined to stop the work at all costs. Independent producer Reese Ehrlich reports.
Here in one of Managua's largest marketplaces, pretty much everyone has an opinion about the new canal. Soyla Medina, a short, feisty woman who works at a food stall, supports it.
In primer lugar, va a haber trabajo para miles de nicaragüenses.
It's great for investment because they need the revenue.
It is good because it's going to create lots of jobs, and also because she thinks people are going to benefit from the taxes that the China is going to pay to the government.
What does she think of the canal's opponents?
Hablan porque son brutos.
They speak because they're dumb and they don't know what they're talking about. That how many of these people have been to Panama? That she's been to Panama and that she sees all the revenue they get. And it is beautiful in Panama.
Sitting in a small stand selling housewares, Manuel Aguilar begs to differ. He criticizes the canal developer, Hong Kong Nicaragua Development, because it has the legal right to confiscate land to build the canal and any other related project.
In the farmer sector, the indigenous people, they're really concerned about their land being taken away from them, and they're very concerned that the pay is not going to be fair, and they're fighting about it.
The canal is one of the largest infrastructure projects in the world. It will stretch over 170 miles from the Caribbean to the Pacific, three times the length of the Panama Canal. But unlike Panama, it will be big enough to handle supertankers taking shale oil and liquefied natural gas from the eastern U.S. to Asia. To do this, the development company will have to dredge a channel through Lake Nicaragua, 80 to 100 feet deep, a process that could disrupt local fishing and tourism. Dozens of towns rely on the lake for drinking water. The Chinese developers have assured Nicaraguans that the environment won't be harmed, but many remain skeptical. A ferry drops anchor here on Ometepe Island in the middle of Lake Nicaragua. This is ground zero for the anti-canal movement. Some 60 farmers gather at an anti-canal meeting. Like everyone else here, Campesino leader Osvaldo Navas is scared the Chinese will seize his land through eminent domain to build hotels.
El patrimonio que...
He's a native from this place. His great-grandfather gave it to his grandfather, and his grandfather gave it to his father, and now he wants to be able to pass it on to his son. And he's afraid they're going to take that away from them. And to them, this is their palace, their home, and their paradise.
Nuestra tierra es nuestro paraíso.
No queremos chino.
The campesinos chant no to the canal. We don't want the Chinese, and we don't want communism either. They have even formed a band to sing an anti-canal ballad, banging out the beat on a painted tortoiseshell. Anger runs so high, many canal opponents accept rumor as fact. For example, Campesino leader Juana Juarez has seen Nicaraguan soldiers accompanying Chinese surveyors and now believes the Chinese are planning to set up a military base on Ometepe.
They are fully aware that these people are not going to go peacefully. So they have to militarize the entire island because they are not going to go down without a fight.
Canal supporters note that China has no military bases anywhere in the world outside of what it says is Chinese territory, and it has no interest in having one in Nicaragua.
This is my map where the canal will cross the coast and all of that.
In the city of Brito, along Nicaragua's Pacific coast, Antonio Granados has a different view of the canal. He drives his new SUV along a rutted dirt road.
We are in Miramar property. Miramar property is where the canal will cross, you know.
Right where we are now is where the canal will be.
Exactly.
Granados is a big landowner whose property lies directly along the canal route. He drives a few more miles to where the Brito River meets the Pacific. There's little more than a few fishermen shacks here, but Granados says that could all change in the next 5 years.
This is the canal, and the pier will be here, this side of the river. Okay, here will be the pier, and all this area will be their industrial area.
Altogether, the development company estimates some 35,000 Nicaraguans will be displaced by the canal and related projects. The company will be responsible for compensating and relocating them. Granados expects large landowners to receive fair market value for their property. But what about the campesinos, who own little besides the land and don't want to lose it?
People think that way, you know. It's a principle that people have, you know, and at the end you have to adjust your principle too, you know. So the land for me had to be from who make more efficient the production of the land.
That vision of prosperity has the full support of the government of President Daniel Ortega. He was known as a leftist firebrand Sandinista in the 1980s, but has now moved towards the political center. His support of the canal and big business have angered former comrades like Ernesto Cardenal, the country's best-known poet.
Porque ya no fue revolución, sino un gobierno corrupto.
The revolution wasn't made to have a corrupt government. They've robbed millions of dollars. It's no longer a popular or leftist revolution. It's a personal dictatorship of Ortega and his wife.
Opinion polls show most Nicaraguans support the canal, but a majority of those who live along the canal route do not. Thousands of campesinos and environmentalists have rallied against the project, catching the government by surprise. Demonstrators threw rocks, the government arrested and beat protesters. The anti-canal movement is having an impact. Mike Healy is president of the Agribusiness Producers Association of Nicaragua and a canal supporter. He says the government should talk with the protesters.
When people is uncomfortable, it creates a lot of tension. And when tension is not good for the investors, you know. So I believe that, you know, if you can have a dialogue, you know, the government has good people dialoguing with these people, possibly things can come out of that, you know.
Over the next few months, Hong Kong-Nicaragua Development plans to buy up land along the canal route and then begin construction of related projects like seaports and worker housing. Work on the canal itself, including dredging Lake Nicaragua, is months, if not years, away. Back on Ometepe Island, the campesinos vow to continue their struggle until the canal is stopped. Campesino leader Osvaldo Navas quotes a famous Nicaraguan poet to make his point.
Somos gente hospitalaria, gente humana, muy amable, capaz de...
Nicaraguans are very polite, open people, but as well as they can hand you the olive branch, they can hand you, cut you up with a machete.
El acero de la guerra.
For Latino USA, I'm Reese Erlich.
Coming up on Latino USA, New Mexico gave driver's licenses to undocumented people, but now the governor wants to take them back.
It is time to repeal the dangerous law that gives driver's licenses to illegal immigrants who come here from around the world.
Stay with us. No se vayan. Thanks for listening to Latino USA. So if you ever talk back to your podcast, we want you to be a part of NPR Listens. Share your opinions and your feedback on NPR's radio shows and podcasts. If you love something or if you want something to evolve, just have your say as part of NPR Listens. Learn more at nprlistens.org.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, helping people build measurably better lives, supporting efforts to improve women's economic opportunities around the world. More information is available at hewlett.org. And the May Family Foundation, supporting Fountain House, committed to providing opportunities for people with mental illness to live, work, and learn through a community of mutual support. Information is available at fountainhouse.org.
Welcome back to Your Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. In 2003, New Mexico became one of the first states to adopt a law that allowed undocumented immigrants to get their driver's licenses. But now, that's the target of a repeal effort led by Republican Governor Susana Martinez. Tom Trowbridge of KSFR reports from Santa Fe.
On a late winter afternoon, Victoria climbs into her old Hyundai to pick up her son from Santa Fe High School. Victoria's asked us to use just her first name. She immigrated to the U.S. from Mexico in the 1990s. She's undocumented, but she applied for a New Mexico driver's license as soon as the state passed a law allowing her to. The law sought to have all New Mexico drivers registered and insured. That was back in 2003.
In mi vida antes de mi licencia era primero andar en
Before that, life was really hard, she says. I had to take the bus, which made it difficult because most of my jobs were outside the city. Plus, I had to walk through the snow with my son.
Y ir caminando en plena nieve en tiempo de invierno.
Now, Victoria's legal right to drive is threatened. New Mexico Governor Susana Martinez, a Republican who was reelected in a landslide last November, wants to repeal the immigrant license law. Here she is in this year's State of the State speech.
Let's do what the people we represent have demanded. It is time to repeal the dangerous law that gives driver's licenses to illegal immigrants who come here from around the world.
Polls show about 70% of New Mexicans oppose the license law, but attempts to repeal it went nowhere until this year when Republicans won control of the State House of Representatives. They passed the repeal on a party line vote.
So some will lose their driving privileges immediately, and some will have up to, you know, a couple of years depending on when their current driver's license expires.
Demicia Padilla is New Mexico's Secretary of Taxation and Revenue. Her agency oversees the state's motor vehicle division. Padilla estimates some 90,000 people stand to lose their licenses, more than the population of Santa Fe. But she denies the repeal effort is anti-immigrant.
Immigration is really an issue for Congress to take up. I think they've done a poor job of not addressing the issue, but my job is not immigration.
But supporters of the license law say it does hurt immigrants. Last month, about 1,000 people marched to the state capitol to protest the repeal effort. Children carried New Mexico flags and wore bright yellow T-shirts that said, "My mother is an immigrant. Keep our parents licensed."
What's your name?
My name is Maria Benavente. I'm 17 years old. I'm a junior and I attend Monte del Sol Charter School, and I'm here to support all of those immigrant families that need their licenses to work and to take their kids to school.
And tell me what your sign says.
My sign says, "Mis padres son gente honesta," which means my parents are honest people.
The impact of the law's repeal on children has Democratic lawmakers concerned. One is Albuquerque Representative Javier Martinez, whose parents emigrated from Mexico.
If we repeal this law, we are telling 90,000 New Mexican U.S.-born kids that we no longer value the input of at least one of their parents.
Heading to Santa Fe High School, Victoria says having a driver's license means more than just getting around. It helps keep her family healthy by allowing them to get to doctor's appointments, and it keeps her son going to his violin lessons. She's pushing back against the repeal with one of the few tools she has.
Principalmente es cuando voy a reuniones con el grupo en el que me reúno.
I use my driver's license to go to the Capitol, she says, or to speak to legislators to fight to protect driver's licenses. And I'll take people who can't drive to protests.
gente que no puede manejar, yo los llevo, los recojo y los llevo a la protesta. Terminando la protesta, yo los regreso a la casa.
The New Mexico Senate, which is controlled by Democrats, is unlikely to pass the repeal this session. But with popular opinion against these licenses, the future is anyone's guess. For Latino USA, I'm Tom Tropridge in Santa Fe.
Now, a driver's license might be something that everybody wants or needs, but a diagnosis of cancer is something you never want to hear about. Still, for veteran radio producer Joe Bevilacqua, his cancer diagnosis ended up having an unexpected benefit. Joe struck up a friendship with the cab driver who took him to his radiation treatments. He's a Chilean immigrant named Patrick Nilo. Every weekday for 7 weeks, Patrick picked Joe up at his home in New York's Catskill Mountains and took him to the hospital. Joe Bevilacqua brings us his audio postcard now about their journey to and from and their friendship.
Have fun.
Thank you, dear.
Being zapped.
Zapparoonie. Hi, girl.
Good morning.
Good morning.
How you doing?
I'm great.
So how you feeling today?
I feel good. I feel strong. I feel like my energy's back. I feel like I've...
Come back to life again.
I feel like I'm coming back to life, yeah.
I do medical transportation. That's why I'm taking Joe this morning to his appointment in Poughkeepsie.
Who are you talking to?
Joe.
I'm Joe.
Yeah, you're Joe.
I know. There might be somebody listening out there.
You know, the idea was because we was young. So we want to come to the United States and just get, say, $10,000-$20,000 and go back to Chile and we'd be rich. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
But we fell in love with the country. We like the system. We like the freedom, you know. So we stayed. After a few years, I got my green card. And after that, I became a proud American citizen. Well, you know what happened? This area is so beautiful.
It's gorgeous here.
I don't know, because the mountain we have all around Ellenville.
Yeah,
and because I born looking the Andes.
Yeah, right.
In Chile, you know, so I'm used to the mountains.
Yeah. Well, this drive is beautiful. Every day.
Yes.
And like, we've been doing it now for 6 weeks. We're seeing the change of the season right in front of us, like a giant moving picture right in front of, like a movie, right out the window every single day. They're very nice to me here.
Yeah.
They treat everybody very nicely inside.
Yeah, they're very nice in here, yeah.
He had his own van.
Well, how you doing?
I made it. Gee whiz, they kept me a long time. I feel like the cancer was my lucky charm.
Yeah.
But what it really did for me was I was feeling a little isolated at home, working on my stuff by myself, doing my radio shows by myself, getting a big audience downloading my stuff and buying my work, but not really personal contact. And here I found you, with somebody who wanted to talk to me, you know, wanted to listen, too. What's interesting to me, and maybe you could say something about how you think, but you're an immigrant. You came here from another country, and I think sometimes there's a feeling of people that were born here that we take everything for granted. We don't really appreciate what we have, and we don't know what it's like in other countries.
Exactly.
So from that perspective, what is it about this country that you see that you don't think people who were born here see?
The freedom. The freedom you have in here, have elections, you can go and vote. If you work hard, you can get many, many things in life. And you have water, you have food. I learned a lot of things too, you know? You learn from me, I learn from you. So.
I definitely learned from you. Yeah. But I won't be with you very much longer yet.
Yeah,
This is my seventh week.
Yeah.
So we're almost done.
You know? I'm very happy. I'm not going to see your face again. You know what I mean? And I mean in the good way. I'm very glad for you, you know. Very glad for you. You're going to be okay. You are a winner, you know.
Thank you.
And keep it that way.
Thank you.
And I wish you the best. We're here in your house.
All right.
Thank God I'm not going to see you again. You know what I mean?
Joey,
thank
good you,
luck, sir. Good luck. Be good, okay?
I love you.
That audio postcard comes to us from radio producer Joe Bevilacqua from New York's Catskill Mountains. Blackstone Audio will be releasing Joe Bev's entire account of his travels with Patrick as an audiobook called The Cancer Cabbie Chronicles. It's available this summer at joebev.com and wherever you find your audiobooks. Musicians are especially familiar with the idea of getting from here to there. And I mean that literally. To build a fan base the traditional way, you have to be on tour all the time. That was the case for Jessica Hernandez and her band, The Deltas. Jessica grew up in a Mexican-Cuban family in southwest Detroit. As a young adult, she converted the loft above her family's bakery into an underground concert venue. She and her band would perform there and around Detroit quite often. But they wanted to make a mark on the world beyond Detroit, and so eventually they hit the road. Jessica brings us this week's Sabiduría, or Words of Wisdom, about life inside the tour van.
The first time I got in the van, the first couple times were pretty awful, to be honest. I think you have this idea of tour before you start actually doing it. And you think, like, this is going to be the most amazing vacation ever with my friends. And, you know, the reality of it hits you and you start thinking, like, oh, my God, this is really hard work. I remember once we played a show in St. Louis and we drove. That day we had a long drive and everyone was really cranky, exhausted. We drive to St. Louis. We get to the venue. We load in. We sound check. We go get some food. We come back right before the first band starts and there's four people in the audience. And it's, you know, the boyfriend of the opening girl and then, you know, a couple parents from the second band. And we were just like, oh, God. So the first band plays and then the girl leaves with her boyfriend. The second band plays, the second band leaves with their parents. And it was literally us, the bartender, the sound guy, and the woman working at the door. And I went to the woman at the door and I was like, hey, should we just go home? Because, I mean, there's literally nobody here. And she's like, not if you want to get paid. And I was like, oh, okay, well, guys, I'm so sorry, but we're going to have to play the show or we're not going to have gas money. So get your crap and let's get on stage. So we get on stage and, like, I was like, okay, the only way that this is not going to be the most soul-sucking experience is if I try and make this as fun as possible. So I just was, like, talking to the people working, and I was like, okay, we're just gonna, you guys shout out, a genre and, you know, some type of category or some type of word or whatever, and I'm just gonna make up a song. And so I think they were like, okay, make a funk song about, like, alien guts. We'd shout out a key and be like, okay, E minor, alien.
I'm an alien. I got my guts in me.
Even in the worst situation, you just have fun, and that's it. It's an interesting life when you spend, you know, more than 50% of your time in a van with five other people. I mean, it took us probably a year and a half to get into a groove of understanding each other's boundaries and understanding each other's limits and knowing, okay, this person doesn't like when I chew with my mouth open, or like, you know, Jess hates when I cut my toenails in the van. Or you also start incorporating things that pass the time. Like we play a lot of Yahtzee, we play a lot of euchre. You start getting into really weird things. Like we started getting really into reading Craigslist personal ads, just because you start going a little bit crazy and you end up learning things about each other that you probably shouldn't know. I love touring. I mean, the first year it definitely was harder because you are pouring your entire soul into a performance every night, and sometimes it's for four people. But then when you slowly start to see the audiences grow and you go from playing a bar to a club to a theater and you start to see that transition, it's the most rewarding thing because you started from the bottom and you put in like the hard work of like the years of touring without people being there. And so it means so much more when you can fill a room. So yeah, it's super rewarding, and it's so exciting, like being in a band with my actual friends from Detroit, because you get to experience that together and you're not like, oh man, I wish I had someone to share this moment with. You know, it's, we all kind of went through it and get it and get to be excited about it together.
You said you'd always be your friend, but lovers first is hard to follow.
These days, Jessica Hernandez and the Deltas play for way more than just four people. Look out for them in a city near you and check out their debut album titled Secret Evil.
Not saying that I've got regrets.
All right, mis queridos listeners, before we go, I have a couple of favors to ask you. If you listen to us on iTunes, please take a couple of minutes and rate our show. Believe me, this would be a big help, and it would get more people listening to us, which I think you'd like. And if you really love what we do here and you're near a computer or a phone, head over to latinousa.org. There's a donate button there. $10 from everyone who hears this would make a huge difference in helping us make radio for you. And that's it for this week, mis queridos. Latino USA is produced by AC Valdez, Lita Hartman, Daisy Rosario, Marlon Bishop, Michael Simon Johnson, Camilo Vargas, and Antonia Cerejido. Our engineer is Cornelius McMoyler. Nadia Raymond is our music consultant. Our intern is Laura Calzada. Nancy Trujillo makes it all happen. Our show is founded at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week, and in the meantime, we'll see you on Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, and I'll catch you on Instagram.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all. The Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide. And the Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and the strengthening of international peace and security. At carnegie.org.
Oof. Oof.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, presenting the MacArthur Award for Creative and Effective Institutions. This year's recipients and more information are at macfound.org. And Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and the advancement of international peace and security. More information is available online at carnegie.org. This is NPR.
Queridos y queridas, if you love what we do here at Latino USA, I hope you'll take a moment to go to latinousa.org and click on the donate button to support our work. As you know, we're a nonprofit, so contributions from you, no matter what the size, are what makes this podcast possible. Gracias for believing in what we do. Do help us, y hasta la próxima.